Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on February 4th, 2020. This class introduces the third week of our 12-week Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. This week's study is on the Four Noble Truths. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
So, this is week three of our Tuesday Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. The same topic is taught both on Saturday and Tuesday. So this is the second half of what's included in the book, the chapter, the third week's chapter on the Four Noble Truths. We started with developing an understanding of jhana meditation, learning the right method, the meditation method taught by the Buddha. And the second week was on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, where the Buddha establishes how to do jhana meditation. And so now we're at this part of the Buddha's Dhamma that is to be seen as the entire context for everything he ever taught. It's the Four Noble Truths. And a well-concentrated mind, supporting the refined mindfulness that's necessary to frame the Eightfold Path as our practice, is the way that we develop an understanding of these Four Noble Truths. And I briefly described why we call them Noble Truths, and I won't get into the royal lineage analogy because that can be confusing, but it's basically this, that these truths are true throughout time and they relate directly to the Dhamma. So making a statement that the sky is blue is true, isn't it? But it's not a noble truth because it has nothing to do with the Dhamma. Kevin has a nice red sweater on. It's true. But it has nothing to do with the Dhamma. My best friend was screaming and hollering this afternoon. It's true. It has nothing to do with the Dhamma. These four noble truths are the Dhamma. And understanding these four noble truths through direct experience is the Dhamma. Well, let me get into
it. I thought of a word for that, omniscient. You know, that's kind of what the Four Noble Truths are, meaning they contain.
Yes, they're it's overarching. The problem with the, not to argue with you, omniscient does have mystical connotations at times. Yeah. And there's nothing magical or mystical about anything the Buddha taught. Everything he taught, especially these four truths, are entirely practical. Thank you for that. And that's the way to see this. By entering Dhamma study through the Four Noble Truths, we will avoid getting distracted by things that the Buddha never taught, yet have become very popular and have been applied the Buddhist label. And just because something's called Buddhism doesn't mean the Buddha taught it. In fact, most of it, you know, you could, if you wanted to put a number on it, you could probably say that 95% of what is called Buddhism isn't. And the 5% that's overlooked and hardly ever practiced is it. And we're learning that. It's that information isn't hidden. It's simply ignored. And even during the Buddhist time, it was ignored. But that ignoring that is the essence of ignorance, isn't it? Including in the problem of ignorance of Four Noble Truths is a mind rooted in ignorance will create very powerful and subtle strategies to ignore who and what it is, to ignore its own ignorance. And we're going to touch on that. So I'm going back a couple of pages into what we read and covered on Saturday, just to put this in context. But this really makes the point. The ego personality is as impermanent as any other aspect or the environment with which it is a part of. In fact,
could you tell me what page that is?
I can't. I'm on a Kindle. It's about... it's about 45% through, if that helps you.
Okay.
You want me to give you a second to catch up? I started with the ego personality is as impermanent.
Page 92.
There you go.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I'll say it again. The ego personality is as impermanent as any other aspect of the environment of which it is a part. So in other words, we looked at this very deeply through our structured study of Vipassana over the summer. This is where the Dhamma resolves and revolves. It resolves within the individual. How could it be any other way? And it is the problem of hoping to establish a permanent self or at least permanent ideals within this ever-changing environment that causes stress. An awakened human being simply sees itself as an ever-changing process in response to what's occurring outside of itself, without the need for anything to be any different than it is, through this understanding. In fact, through insight gained through jhana meditation, the ego personality will be seen as a constantly changing creation of your own views. And if those views are rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, what are we creating? We're creating a human being who is rooted in ignorance of who it is in relation to the world and constantly prone to stress and suffering because of that ignorance. A Dhamma practitioner understands where it began, ignorance of Four Noble Truths, and because of the structure of the Eightfold Path, understands moment by moment in its Dhamma practice where it's going. Is everybody clear on that last thing I said? Mm-hmm. And so you've heard me say often that each moment in Dhamma practice, each moment in life, but in Dhamma practice, we have the focus to recognize that in this moment, I have a choice. I can either continue to ignore my own ignorance and continue stress and suffering, or I can incorporate the Dhamma, the heart with the Dhamma, the Eightfold Path, and in this moment, incline my mind towards continued awakening. And that really, as far as Dhamma practitioners, that's the only choice we ever have. And even post-awakening, we know this from people that have, even post-awakening, we are maintaining that point of view, a right view. That's the whole essence of it. And that right view is constantly malleable, meaning that it's learning ever deeper ways of applying the Dhamma to what's occurring. I got a question a few years ago, and I've mentioned it a few times, and it was from an online student. It said, why did the Buddha keep meditating after he awakened? Think about the question. It's rooted in someone who has an aversion to meditation is doing it only to reach the goal. Hopefully the goal. Of course, an awakened human being would meditate. There's not much more pleasant things that an awakened human being would do. Doesn't mean we live in meditation, but it means we establish that right view, and that right view is our guidance through moment by moment life. And that right view is ever changing, but it's always framed by the Eightfold Path. Not understanding the impermanence of the ego personality and how the ego self creates an identity by clinging to objects, events, views, and ideas is ultimately the cause of all stress. And if you think about that, you're constantly involved moment by moment in your life, yet you don't understand who you are in relation to that life. Because we've been doing it our whole life and because the whole world is acting in the same way, we don't even recognize it. Everybody's doing it. We had a little conversation about that too, and how our associations shape the way we think, the way we feel, and really what we're looking to develop in our life. That's why the Buddha teaches so often. I mean, you could say in probably 50% of the suttas, there's at least the inference to look at your associations and what are you associating with, and ultimately, it's what type of Dhamma or Dharma are you associating. I use the word Dharma to refer to everything the Buddha didn't teach, and Dhamma to refer to what he did teach. And so we associate with the Dhamma. And we associate within here, that's why this place is structured the way it is, with the Dhamma and not with something else. For the sole reason, it's not that it's good or bad or evil or anything like that. Anything else, a self-referential ego personality will grasp onto it and cling to it because it furthers ignorance. We have now defined three key points of this course: the impermanence of all things, including our view of ourselves, the pervasiveness and unavoidable nature of stress. It's the first noble truth, stress occurs. The ego self as an impermanent personality formed by experiences, environment, and its associations. And that environment, if it's rooted in ignorance, can only create a self rooted in ignorance. These are known as the three linked characteristics of existence. That was what our study was over the summer, the study of Vipassana. The original Pali language there called anicca, dukkha, and anatta, or impermanence, stress, and the not-self characteristic. We will look deeper at these three characteristics of existence in week 7. For now, it is enough to know that it is a lack of knowledge or ignorance of who you are and an aversion to acknowledging the environment that you exist in that continues stress and unhappiness. And, you know, kind of a long sentence, but ultimately awakening is dependent on simply acknowledging that I don't know what Four Noble Truths are. And because of this is the self-reflective view, the true self-reflective view, that because of this ignorance, I have, remember the Salata Sutta, I've created all the confusion, delusion, stress, and suffering in my life. It has nothing to do with any outside condition or agency or mistake of birth, lack of funds, lack of power, lack of position, lack of brains, lack of the right teacher. It has none of that. None of that has any bearing on awakening. The only thing that bears on awakening is my own relationship to the Four Noble Truths. And if I engage in developing this understanding wholeheartedly in the structure that was presented by an awakened human being, I will awaken. And I will awaken more than likely in this lifetime. You remember the many suttas where the Buddha teaches just that. He doesn't predict it. He doesn't promise it. He says, if you do this in 7 years, no six, no five, no four, no three, no two, no one, maybe even in a week, you will awaken. Because that's the Dhamma that he taught. He didn't teach something that would have it grasping endlessly into the future at something that we might get because of some merit or ritual or promise that was made to us. We awaken based on our own right effort, not anything else. There's nothing that bears on our awakening save our own right effort. And we're all experiencing that, aren't we? It is through our own right effort that we have the discussions in this place where we talk about, yeah, this is different in me. I see this different. This situation is completely different now. Or my experience of the situation is completely different because I'm seeing it differently. My mind is going from a mind rooted in wrong view to a mind that is developing right view. And the results are almost immediate. Wisdom is gaining an understanding of impermanence and the ego personality. Wisdom is gaining an understanding of impermanence, the nature we live in, and the ego personality. What am I? Now remember, the Buddha said that every human being is made up of six properties and nothing else. In other words, nothing can be added in a permanent way to the four earth elements, the fifth property of space, the space property, and the sixth property of consciousness, meaning ongoing thinking, and in this case, ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. It's not some grand cosmic consciousness. It's simply this ordinary thinking that is supporting ignorance of Four Noble Truths if I maintain that thinking. The only way that I can do that, and this is what the Buddha considered for 2 weeks post his awakening, understanding the problem of human ignorance, Siddhartha still had to figure out how can I pierce that veil of ignorance, because he experienced it himself. Remember the Nagara Sutta. He understood how strong it was, how nearly impossible it was to see this in ourselves, because it's the nature of ignorance to ignore itself. It's included in the word. And yet he figured out a way. He figured out a way how a mind that is rooted in ignorance can actually recognize that ignorance. Another way of saying it, how would a mind that is completely deluded know that it's deluded? How would it? It couldn't, unless it had a way of actually recognizing its delusion. It had a framework, and that's the Eightfold Path. That's why the Buddha taught the Eightfold Path, to pierce that veil of ignorance. And that is the aspect of the Fourth Noble Truth that speaks to the third noble truth of cessation of ignorance, cessation of stress as possible. And that speaks to the impermanence that I'm just, what we're talking about right here. When taking a realistic view of who and what you are and the choices and attachments you make, wisdom is recognizing poor choices and unskillful attachments to objects, events, and ideas, and views that have arisen from ignorance. And the problem with that is a self-referential ego self does not ever want to admit it's wrong. And it certainly doesn't want to let go of anything that it has taken ownership of, meaning through self-identification. And it does this with every single idea, every thought that occurs becomes a self-referential thought to a mind rooted in ignorance. And once the thought has occurred, clinging has also occurred. Remember dependent origination and how it progresses. We've talked about that and we're going to talk a little bit more about this in week six, that process from ignorance of Four Noble Truths resulting in stress and suffering, the 12 causative links, happens so quickly that it might as well be considered as it happens outside of time. We can't notice it. We don't have human mind is will never be quick enough to notice that process, but we can break it down and know that it occurs because we can see it occurring in ourselves. And that between the sixth and seventh factor of, I think, or the seventh and eighth factor of dependent origination is clinging and maintaining. From craving comes clinging and maintaining. That simply means that I'm clinging to and maintaining views rooted in ignorance. Is that clear? And so that informs where we're going with this. We first have to find a way to recognize our ignorance of these Four Noble Truths and a way to develop understanding. Again, it's all part of the Eightfold Path.
What gives rise to ignorance?
It's a good question. Does anybody want to answer that? Give me a break. Get a drink. I should say I need a drink after that question.
Something's dependent on ignorance. I mean, if ignorance is fabrications are dependent on ignorance, and you're completely aware of the Four Noble Truths, but yet you still get caught up, that means that ignorance is dependent on a hindrance. Because if my mind is stuck in ill will or greed or one of those hindrances where I'm not able to recognize the aggregates, then it's off to the races.
It is. Thank you. It's such a fundamental question. And you're right that hindrances inform ignorance, but ignorance creates hindrances as well. So you ask, where does ignorance come from?
Dukkha, from birth. Right. Dukkha, from the truth.
The Buddha started his whole dispensation by saying dukkha occurs. Dukkha. And then he resolved that into ignorance. So we can get lost into trying to, and he said, don't go past that. This is the Dhamma practice, understanding that my problem today, the reason why I came here, the reason why when I was 12 years old, I started looking for answers. I thought I found it in LSD and psilocybin for a while. Then I thought I found it in the bottom of a vodka bottle and a bag of dope because they provided the distraction from that, that's my own stress of not knowing who I was. But all of that was rooted in ignorance. And so the resolution is developing that understanding of ignorance. It doesn't matter where it came from. It's like, where did I come from? Those questions, those grand mystical questions that Vajragoda asked the Buddha. Where did you come from? What happens to you when you die? The Buddha always blew those off. Why? Not because he was trying to be arrogant or dismissive in any way, because he knew if even getting in, even trying to attempt to answer the question was a distraction and gave credence to the ignorance that's underneath the question. So now I'm not saying you're ignorant.
Yeah, no, but I don't live my life in a vacuum.
No, but the point is that I find myself not understanding stress. That's ignorance. What does it matter where it came from?
What causes you not to understand stress? If you already know right view.
I don't. I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about
I'm talking about a Dhamma practitioner. If you are completely aware of what stress is, you mm-hmm. have the experience of stress.
Yep.
You don't want stress. You don't like stress. And you understand the ego personality's relation to the five clinging aggregates.
Yep.
But you don't live your life in a monastic way. And you're engaging in the world from moment to moment from people who are not Dhamma practitioners. And you're constantly battling, wanting things to be different than they are because now you're stuck in a hindrance. You're in greed. You're in a desire. So as soon as you're desiring something, you're lacking something.
It's because your practice isn't.
And it still comes back to the first noble truth and these four noble truths. You're describing dukkha,
right.
and you're.
So how do you get out of that?
Oh, Dhamma practice. I mean, I don't mean to be quick with that.
No,
that's
I want to sit on a hill.
That's the whole
waterfall. You know?
So
dukkha will still occur.
I don't just to continue with this. I'm not. I don't mean this as a in any way disrespectful. Go ahead.
No, that's what I'm talking about. Though.
No, I know. But Siddhartha Gautama had the same understanding. He realized that this man grew up in more luxury than most people could imagine, and yet he called it a confining place.
Right. He had to get rid of it.
He could yes, and because understanding was more important to him than that. And so he left all that behind. I'm not saying you should do that or saying anybody should do it, but he did it. But it's not, it's not absolutely necessary, because there's many people that developed awakening. Anathapindika always comes to mind, who was a very wealthy businessman, met the Buddha, and continued with his business practices, and yet he awakened, and many other people did. So you started this with, where does ignorance come from? We understand ignorance doesn't come from anywhere. It is. Where do I come from? I don't have to answer that. I know here I am. This is what I have to deal with. If I insist that I know where I came from and where I'm going to go when I die, I've lost what's going on right now, haven't I? If I'm concerned about what caused ignorance in me in the first place, I'm not focusing on the fact that right now I am ignorant. And the other, there's really two questions to what you asked. So how do I deal with this in the world? It's only, the only way that I know is through Dhamma practice. And so I would ask you, Frank, I want to get back to the book though. Has those situations in the world, has the stress in those situations diminished since you've been practicing the Dhamma?
Feelings arise, thoughts arise, I come back to the breath. Mm-hmm. I'm mindful of the quality of mind.
Yeah.
It's constantly engaging with the world. It's changing from moment to moment. The ignorance that creates the stress isn't there, but the stress that's there is definitely depending on something, and that is the quality of my mind,
yes,
which is dependent on the hindrance. The quality of my mind.
Well, the hindrance is a manifestation of ignorance. It's not the cause of ignorance.
So that's got to be the feedback loop.
Yeah.
Right there.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Identifying with the feelings and the thoughts.
Yep. And making them real when they're not. There's not one feeling that it...
Making
that,
it personal.
Yes, exactly.
Like almost instantly.
Yeah.
You can personalize.
And even if it's just, I understand the Dhamma, why don't these people understand the Dhamma and leave me alone? That's a self-referential thought, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And that that's kind of an easy one to fall in when we've developed a little bit of understanding. Why can't they be like me? Of course they can't be like you. Well, dukkha occurs.
It's seeing yourself in the world.
Yeah.
Filled with stress.
Yep.
Anxiety or whatever.
Yeah, so we don't want to be in the world in that way. We don't want to be entangled to the world. Michael?
Just speaking to that.
Well, can this wait till later then? Because I don't want to get into a discussion now. I want to get to the,
sure,
through the reading. If it's book, though, we can get to it.
Sure. No, well, it's quick. It's
okay.
Quick.
All right. Let's hear it.
Real quick, okay? I know time limitations. When the mind is united with the body, okay, that's the key.
Yeah.
Dispassion arises, okay? This dispassion,
I agree,
is pause to whatever is occurring. In that pause, in that moment of, that silent moment, that pausing, the Eightfold Path is, the integrated Eightfold Path enables us to deal with any situation that occurs in our lives. But the dispassion that, when the mind is united with the body, dispassion is what gives us that buffer zone to follow the Eightfold Path.
Yes.
And therein,
well said.
And therein the situation will resolve.
Yeah. If our minds are agitated in the moment, it's simply because I've lost my mind. I don't mean in a psychological sense. In this moment, I've lost my mind. I've become distracted and attached to and entangled in the world again. What do I do? Take a breath. And just what Frank described. Take a breath, come back into my body. Let me continue. Wisdom is making informed decisions based on the true nature of existence. The task associated, at the beginning of the week, I mentioned that the developing understanding of the Four Noble Truths can be seen as developing very specific skills to develop, to complete certain tasks. The task associated with the First Noble Truth is to fully understand stress. That's how the Buddha described awakening. A human being who has awakened has a profound understanding of stress. And as a result, he described the quality of mind of an awakened human being, that as a result of that understanding, that mind is resting in calm and equanimity, no matter what. And it's because of the situation that Frank describes that applies to that so well. I understand the nature of stress. I understand the ignorance of other people living in the world. I don't take it personally. I don't insist that they be any different than they are. And because of that understanding, my mind doesn't react to worldly events anymore. And I bet you all of us can say, at least to a measure of that, that that's developed. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the Dhamma. Ignorance is insisting that the personality viewed as I or me is permanent. Of course it's not. Ignorance is continually reacting to life based on what makes the personality feel good or what this personality wishes to avoid, grasping after. This is simplistically called feeding the ego. The problem is much more complex as a personality unfolds. The originating cause is simple. The truth of the origination of unhappiness and stress, clinging, craving, desire, and aversion all cause stress. Wanting the people and events of our lives to be different than they are is craving or desire. Wanting two cookies instead of one is craving and desire. If my mind gets upset because mommy didn't give me that second cookie, that's an example of me creating stress in my life. It's a kind of a silly example, but we do that with not getting a second cookie and people not acting the way we want them to act. Attachment to the people and events of your life to remain as they are is also clinging. Clinging arises due to a singular identity as your personality. Who you think you are is all you think you are. Due to this initial wrong view of yourself, you believe that your personality is all that you are. As a consequence of this wrong view of self, you have developed a constant need to defend and satiate your ego personality. In other words, the driving force for all grasping after and clinging to acquisitions is the underlying belief that this is just not enough. There needs to be more to me to be successful or happy or have my place in the world. Or a little bit more psychologically damaged mind would think that there's something wrong with itself. There's something broke. And as you take this deeper and deeper into psychoses, you get to the point where you can't even trust yourself anymore. You might be stuck in severe anxiety. I was for many years. I was on medication for it. I stopped taking medication against medical advice and started meditating. I never took another drug in my life. Now I'm taking some aspirin and some antibiotics, but that's it. And it was all because of a wrong view of myself in relation to the world that I thought myself into the place where I couldn't even answer the phone. I was so afraid of what was out there. I couldn't open my mail. I mean, I was also drinking and doing a lot of drugs that make you a little crazy too. All of that left when I got rid of the drugs and alcohol and I started meditating and developing an understanding of who I was. And all of you, whether you had those types of severe addictions or just simply normal adult human compulsive behavior, every one of you have talked about diminishing those behaviors. That's what the Dhamma is about. When we are compulsive about our actions and the way that we think, it's because our minds are rooted in ignorance, because we're grasping after, always adding to this self or always protecting this self. When in fact, this self doesn't need anything and it never needs any protection. And again, I'm not talking about practical protection. I think of the question was asked in our very first retreat. And I was talking about not, in fact, I think it was chapter 7 too. And I could see this gentleman getting a little bit excited about this, the ramifications of what I was teaching. And he thought that I was teaching the common view that there's no such thing as a self and we always live in emptiness and nothingness. Of course, the Buddha never taught anything like that and I don't. But that was his belief. And so he says, well, what do you do? What do you do when a train's coming out and you're on the train tracks? You take two steps to the right, get off the train tracks. That's being a human being. It means you have the sense to do that. But taking the fact that that train was coming after me at too fast a speed and that I had to get off the train tracks and taking that personally is a self-referential ego personality. Take two steps to the right, take a breath, get on with your life. There was no hidden meaning in any of that. Letting go of clinging does not mean that you won't have physical and emotional needs met. In fact, it means just the opposite. It means ultimately you won't have physical or emotional needs that aren't getting met. Letting go of clinging means letting go of the mental preoccupation of attachments to the people and events of your life. Letting go of clinging is also letting go of all views arising from ignorance. Through jhana meditation within the framework of the Eightfold Path, you will gain insight into your ego personality and the choices and attachments you make arising from wrong view. You will begin to realize that sensory-driven impulses animate much of what we all do. you will see how clinging and desire is ego personality based. Until we get to the Dhamma and start slowing down and calming down, a lot of our energy is spent on that idea of acquiring things for me, chasing after the things that I feel I need to stay happy and safe, or chasing after the things that I think I need next to acquire, or chasing after the people that I think I want in my life. And the consequence, the opposite is also true as well. I become preoccupied with anything that I think might take away from me and what I need and what I want. And there's this ongoing tension that of always grasping after or aversion. And that becomes the underlying fabric of our life. Rather than doing what the Buddha teaches, to simply be present with my life as my life unfolds. And then, no matter what it is, no matter what's occurring, it's meaningful. And it's meaningful why? Because now I have a human life that's involved in what's occurring. I don't need it to be any different. There's no aversion. It's simply what is. And so when impossible customers or impossible workloads come into my day, I'm able to do what Frank does. I take a breath, I come back into my body, and then I address it from a mindful standpoint rather than a reactive standpoint. Again, it's the ultimate practical teaching that Siddhartha Gautama gave us. He didn't teach us how to escape the world or how to find ourselves in a better place in some future lifetime, a million eons from now, as it's often taught. He taught us how to live successful lives, flourishing lives. The opposite of dukkha in Pali is sukha, S-U-K-K-H-A. And that's what it means. It means human flourishing without anything attached to it. Isn't that amazing? And we're all doing that too. We are all talking about how we're flourishing more and more in our moment-by-moment life. Now we'll talk about that in a minute. Most importantly, you will learn how to see your ego personality realistically and not spend your life driven by sensory fulfillment and continually establishing and defend your ego personality. Sorry, it's got to, for some reason, my clock went off. There it is. Okay. I read that a little quick. More importantly, you will learn how to see your ego personality realistically and not spend your life driven by sensory fulfillment and the need to continually establish and defend your ego personality. It is through gaining a realistic view of self and the choices made based on that view that you can begin to put all stress and unhappiness aside. You won't be able to gain a realistic and clear view of self if you continue to remain distracted by your own ego personality and its constant need for attention. This constant attention is the distraction caused by stress. A mind that is constantly distracted by the sensual needs of an ego personality will never be free and at peace. It's always grasping. A mind that has gained the ability to not be distracted by its own sensory-driven needs and desires is a mind free of stress. A mind free of stress is a mind of lasting peace and happiness. The task associated with the second noble truth is to abandon craving and clinging. That's where I asked that question I was talking about before. The truth of the cessation of unhappiness and stress. As we have seen, the cause of stress is craving and clinging in all their forms, arising from a misunderstanding of who we are and the nature of our environment. Experiencing the cessation of stress and unhappiness is letting go of clinging, craving, desire, and aversion. This becomes possible once the true nature of anatta, your ego self, the not-self characteristic, is developed. As you integrate the teachings of this course and understanding of the futility of clinging to any object, view, or idea, in the environment of impermanence, the environment of impermanence is understood. To one seeing the end of stress, this is obviously an important statement of the realization of that truth. It is important to remember that it is within the environment of impermanence that stress arises, and it is also the environment of impermanence that unhappiness and stress ends. In other words, we don't escape ourselves to resolve this issue of ignorance. The issue of ignorance is resolved within ignorance.
Say that again.
The issue of ignorance is resolved within ignorance.
Understanding it.
and abandoning it.
And that can
there's
only
nothing.
Happen,
I'm sorry.
That can only happen through the realization of the third noble truth, through the development of the fourth noble truth.
Yes, the big problem with, and I'll say everything because I've looked at a lot of it with the understanding that maybe there's something I missed. With all the other teachings, is that they're all based on acquiring something, a bit of knowledge, a bit of grace, a bit of merit, a bit of something in the future that has nothing to do with what's occurring right here and right now. The big, I call the Buddha often the biggest radical of his time and our time. The most radical thing that the Buddha ever taught, and it still continues to be the most radical thing in the world, is that there's nothing wrong. I said a few times here that I no longer see any good in the world. People get excited when you say that because you're supposed to see the positive in everything. But I don't see the bad in the world either. I just see the world because that's what the world is. That's what it means. The first noble truth, dukkha occurs, means that as a consequence of having a human life, there is going to be disappointment. There's going to be suffering. Birth is suffering. Sickness is suffering. Aging is suffering. Death is suffering. Not getting what is desired is suffering. Receiving what is undesired is suffering. In short, going through life in an ignorant way, as defined by the five clinging aggregates, form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and that ongoing consciousness, ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, is suffering. It's resolved there. I had a teacher many years ago, you heard me say this a few times, his name was Arnold Patton, and he used to say that if you want to go to Los Angeles and you're in New York but you believe you're in Chicago, you can't get there. The Buddha's Dhamma is applied right where we are. No matter how confused, no matter how deluded, no matter how entrenched we are in ignorance, that's where the Dhamma is met. That's why that Eightfold Path works. Because we develop the Eightfold Path at whatever point we are in the ignorant scale, from really ignorant to really, really ignorant. Doesn't matter. We take a breath, we bring our mind into our body, and we start developing an understanding of this idea of refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. Let me continue. We have identified the problem as stress. We have identified the cause of the problem, craving and clinging. We have seen that experiencing the ending of stress is possible. Good question. Does everybody here tonight believe that it's possible to end our contributions to stress?
Yes.
To gain full human maturity? That's what the definition of awakening?
Yes.
Does anybody not? It's okay.
You know, I don't think it's possible.
Why do you keep doing it then?
Because I think you can get nearer to it, but whether do you actually get there in this world, I don't know.
Do you believe that Siddhartha Gautama did?
Yes.
Do you believe that he's a human being?
Actually beyond what he could teach. Pardon?
Do you believe that he was a human being?
Yes.
Do you believe you're a human being?
I do.
Yeah.
You can awaken. Yeah, I mean, that's what, and I appreciate it. One of the reasons I call on Lorna, because she's always honest. Always honest. The Buddha taught a Dhamma for human beings to awaken in this lifetime. But Lorna's right. If we don't happen to get all the way to the end of the path, it sure makes life a lot better, doesn't it? Moment by moment.
I have a problem with the dispassionate part of feelings and thoughts.
How so?
So I can't really experience it. But I'm not very dispassionate.
When you're sitting in meditation, I don't want to go too deep on this. When you're sitting in meditation and a feeling arises, what do you do?
Come back to my breath.
That's perfect training on being dispassionate about your feelings.
Yeah.
What about when a thought...
I experience it in meditation. I just don't experience it when I'm interacting with people in the world because, you know, I have a tendency to connect with people and I almost feel what they're feeling, kind of.
Yep.
And when somebody is going through something and I'm experiencing their pain, then I'm feeling my own.
Yeah.
And it kind of causes a reaction that gives rise to more feelings and thoughts. So I just constantly coming back to my breath.
But you've seen
I know you've... What was that?
You've seen no difference? since you started?
I see understanding, deepened understanding.
So I know you, Fran, I know you very well, and I know you as a deeply compassionate human being, meaning you really do care about people, whether they're family, friends, or people you just met. I know it. I see it in you all the time. And so what you're developing is the wisdom to understand the suffering that you are so compassionate about and want to do something about. Siddhartha Gautama described himself much like you are when he described himself as, prior to my awakening, when I was an unawakened bodhisattva, which is, get into a discussion about why Mahayana decides that that's the path. But when I was an unawakened bodhisattva, meaning a human being who had great compassion for other human beings, what he's saying is, but at that point, prior to my awakening, I didn't have the wisdom to go with my compassionate, to marry with it, to actually be truly effective. And that doesn't mean that prior to awakening, we shouldn't care about people or even help people, but we'll be able to help people in a much more meaningful way without the stress of needing them to be different than they are or having it reflect back on me. And again, that's just part of the awakening process. The reason why that works, the reason why it happens that way, that we become much more effective in our compassion, is because we are more mindfully present for the things that we are being, the things and the people we're being compassionate about. Again, it's just an aspect of the Dhamma. The framework for developing a deeper understanding of stress, craving, clinging, and the ego self and impermanence is called the Eight Factor or the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is a framework for developing heightened virtue, heightened wisdom, heightened virtue, and heightened concentration, leading to the development of heightened wisdom. Sorry about that. I'm going to stop there because we're going to get into the Eightfold Path next week. That's the end of it's probably about 85% of the chapter. And I know you've all read it this past week. That's a good place to stop because we're going to start looking at the Eightfold Path in next week's class, and we're going to break it down just that way. The first two classes will be on the wisdom factors, right view and right intention. The second week will be on the virtuous factors of right speech, action, and livelihood, and then we'll conclude that that kind of mini-study of the Eightfold Path with a look at right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. But that's enough for tonight, I think. Let me go online you know what? Let me go to Frank first, and then I'll go online. Just, I know you guys might have to leave soon. Eric, how you doing tonight?
Good, how are you?
Good, thanks for asking.
I don't know if I have anything to add to it other than when I was reading the chapter, in the very beginning, it had just talked about a foundation, and I know that just by coming here and listening to you and just doing my best to practice it wholeheartedly.
Yeah.
That the Four Noble Truths really are a foundation. And, that's just what I picked up while I'm the reading.
Yeah. Outstanding. Very good, Eric. Good to see you. Frank.
Good evening. Good to be here. I really don't have anything to add. I kind of took a lot of time. It's a great practice. I can say that my understanding of stress has deepened profoundly.
Yeah.
And I think I feel kind of vulnerable with feelings and thoughts, so I keep coming back to my breath, and I don't like it anyway. And I'm just trying to learn how to be dispassionate to whatever it is I'm experiencing without losing the kindness or the compassion. I'm trying to be dispassionate, but compassionate at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, and that comes with what you're developing. The more wisdom you have about, it's not a wizard type of wisdom. You understand what human life is. And the more we understand that about ourselves, the more we understand it about other people. And we simply stop reacting to them. And you're experiencing that. So.
Yeah, I try to do my best. It's It's either a throat punch or a hug.
Well, but that's better than what it was a little while ago. It was just a throat punch then. Thank you, Frank. Let's go to Jane. Jane, how are you tonight?
I'm fine, John. I'd like to share something that Matt helped me work through this past week, and it kind of relates to what we were just talking about.
Good.
I have a coworker who I care about deeply, and her husband was diagnosed with leukemia. And he's 35 years old, and they have two kids. And I spent a lot of time with her, talking to her, and I mean, I feel her pain and her, you know, she's scared and all of this. And I was talking to Matt about it. And my Dhamma practice tells me that I should be okay with things the way they are and not need them to be differently. But I was having very strong feelings that I wanted it to be different for this family.
Mm-hmm.
And Matt steered me into that it was Jane the fixer coming through.
Yeah.
I wanted to fix the situation. That was my ego coming out. I wanted to fix it, make it better.
Yeah, make it different.
Really, you know, by being present with her, you know, supporting her, crying with her, holding her, that I was doing was enough. That I didn't need to fix anything.
Yeah.
And that helped me quite a bit. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank Matt. You know, that's pretty good. That's pretty good advice. And that really is all we can do. It's a terribly tragic situation. Nobody would deny that a 35-year-old man with a family getting leukemia is just awful. And the Buddha described it 2,600 years ago. Dukkha occurs. And that, you know, to some people that will sound almost dismissive and too simplistic, but it is actually the most helpful way. Your mindful presence with your friend is the most important thing that probably has happened to her in this situation, because that's all we can do. Life isn't fair. It's an aspect of a self-referential ego personality. It's always grasping after and screaming about life isn't fair and how come it's not fair. It can't be fair. I talk about awakening is full human maturity. Just a quick look at human life. That some people are born into human life and live 3 seconds and some people live 100 years. It's not fair. And it's not supposed to be fair. It never can be fair. And so some people live 100 years. My dad lived 101 years. And some people live 35. I buried my best friend when I was 14 years old. It was awful. It bothered me for another 10 years before I could come to grips with it. But that's just life. And the Dhamma teaches us what? To understand it. Not to avoid it. Not to insist that it's different, not to escape it, not to create something in my mind that makes everything positive. It's being able to be present with someone who's 35, with a friend whose husband is 35 years old and is dying of leukemia, and I can stay mindfully present and give them true comfort. That's the Dhamma. So thank you.
Thank you.
Ryan, welcome to our Sangha. Ryan.
Hello.
Hey, yes. There you are.
Can you hear me?
I can. You sound good. What did you think of tonight's class?
It was great. I was having trouble focusing because I'm on my laptop, and I decided to go over to your website at the same time that you were talking and just to kind of orient. And I found the part about the class section.
And, oh, good.
And I was reading about the organization and how it breaks down. And by the way, your organization skills are amazing. I mean, it's like super, super amazing.
Do you hear that, everyone?
True.
Thank you. You're the first. Really? Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. Nobody's ever said that before. So,
actually, like I said, you and I, our personalities are very similar. And I was like marveling at your about how it's all integrated, whether it's on the YouTube, whether it's on the podcast. I mean, it's all really, really well organized. I can tell that you've been doing this for a while.
Thank you.
It's interesting because after, I don't want to use the word studying because that would be inaccurate. After dabbling in Buddhism for about 10 years, I finally decided to start getting serious about it only within the past few months. And I basically just took myself back to the very, very beginning. And I'm actually studying the Four Noble Truths right now. And also I'm taking an online class that's offered by Harvard. And that has really helped me, give me some structure. Because I didn't even start looking at the suttas themselves until recently. Everything that I've been learning in terms of the Buddha and what he taught has been filtered through other people.
Yep.
And I can see how dangerous that could be. So the question I was going to ask you was when you say that 95% of what we're learning is inaccurate or whatever, are you referring, because I imagine from your teachings that you're a part of the that you believe in, or that you follow the Theravada vehicle. Is that correct or not?
Nope.
Oh, I thought because you're talking about the original teachings, I just assumed that you were a follower, or you were in that vehicle, so to speak, because that was supposedly the Buddha's original teachings were the Theravada, as opposed to the Mahayana. Is that not correct?
That's not correct. The word Theravada means the teachings of the elders. So the connotation is that these are the original teachings. What has happened in Theravada and Buddha? And there's two articles on my website that you can look at. One is on the formation and the establishment of the Pali Canon, and then the other was an article called Modern Buddhism: A Thicket of Views, and it explains how Theravada and Mahayana Buddhism came to be. And they came to be as protest to what the Buddha actually taught. The Theravadins tried to maintain some original connection to what the Buddha taught, but they rely on the third book of the Pali Canon called the Abhidhamma. And the Abhidhamma is a very abstract, mystical, and magical, I don't even know what to... a magical and mystical explanation of what the Buddha taught, but it's rooted in the desire for magic and mystery, and also to incorporate many of the themes that are common in modern Mahayana Buddhism. And so the original teachings of the Buddha are the original teachings of the Buddha, and then there's Theravada and Mahayana Buddhism. And when you look at what they're both teaching today, there's hardly any difference. I don't want to go too deep into that. And again, I'm not trying to put down most of modern Buddhism. You know, it's just the way it is. There never has been a good reason to adapt, accommodate, or embellish the Buddha's teachings, yet every modern lineage has. So it comes down to, what am I going to practice? Am I going to practice what the Buddha taught as preserved in the Sutta Pitaka, or will I get into other things? I found, and everybody here has found, that the most effective Dhamma practice is based just on what the Buddha taught. And then, just to continue a little bit, Ryan, this is the third week of this study called the Truth of Happiness Study. On the homepage, if you go down to the bottom, you'll see a link to the Truth of Happiness 2020 study, whatever. It says something similar to that. And the previous talks are there, and each chapter in the book are also, I mean, the book is for sale, but the chapters are online. So if you want, you can just kind of catch up with us and maybe continue this study.
Your email list also updates them too with that. Email list is good to sign up for.
Oh, yeah. You could sign up for my newsletter I send out twice a week that just informs what we're doing here.
I signed up for it at the end of last year. That's how I knew.
Oh,
and
okay.
Like I said, I start this class I'm taking online. It's not time limited, but it's intensive, and I started taking it in October, and I was afraid that if I took a break, I was going to forget everything I learned. That's the reason why I didn't jump on this class. But now I'm trying to see if I'm going to be able to catch up and jump in, because I'm definitely interested.
Yeah, well, I mean, it'll still be there. I'm not going to, it'll be up there indefinitely. So you can pick it up whenever you want. I'm so glad you joined us, and, I hope you continue. Do you have any other questions?
Just to clarify, I don't want to take up enough of the time, but so just because I'm reading, let's say I'm reading a book by an author who claims to be of the Theravada school, that doesn't necessarily mean that what he's teaching is the Buddha's words. Is that correct? I mean, so who do you trust that has been able to interpret the Buddha's teachings in a way that you feel is authentic out there, in terms of either teachers or authors or anybody?
I only trust what's in the suttas. And even then, I have to keep it in. We're going to get it. Give me a call one of these days, or send me an email, because we can get deeper into this. But even the suttas, because of the way they're translated by people, Thanissara Bhikkhu is one of, I think he's one of the best translators, but he's still rooted in the Abhidhamma. So his translations are naturally colored that way. They're conditioned that way. So, and I read a lot of different authors. There's probably six or eight that I choose from. But then my own translation of the suttas is framed by the context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths. And so that makes all the difference. So you know, I hate to tell you, but if you know, it's
but
all
you're the Buddha. You're basically the Buddha of the modern time.
I don't mean to put it like that. I've yet to come across anybody that just practices what's in the suttas, and that's made all the difference. But you know, that's the only way I can answer that. So I have great respect for many of these folks, but I haven't come across anyone that is not influenced and conditioned by their own lineage and who they, you know, who they associate with.
But, that makes sense. Yeah, I'll definitely shoot you an email, which is what I've been meaning to do for a while. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
I look forward to it. Thank you, sir. Matt.
Good night.
See you guys. Good to see you. Right. I see you, Andrew. Please say hello to Judy.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Oh, that was Eric. Who's that tall
guy?
Good
to be here. Good to see everybody. Really enjoying this this year's Truth of Happiness study.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Glad you're here. Hello, Lorna.
Hi.
This never awakens.
What? I was thinking, I've been thinking about what, who's the guy that just left?
Frank?
That's it. Frank was meaning thinking about rest when your mind resting in equanimity is what we say. It seems like it doesn't. It seems like it wants to rest in fabrications and distractions and believing who I am. It feels like that sometimes, that it doesn't want to rest in equanimity. It wants to rest in who I thought I was.
Yes.
But at the same time, I can see that that fog is diminishing. It's getting thinner, and I believe less and less that I believe my own fabrications. I can now see through them a lot clearer. Yeah. And it's a slow process, and I think that's what Frank was talking about, really. Yeah. You know, it's a slow process, but it works, and you just the more skillful you are at abandoning, just not going into how it occurred or why it occurred, or just abandoning, abandoning.
Yeah.
When you get good at just abandoning, then you kind of like hit a bit of an upswing, I think.
Yeah.
You can really start to see through things a little bit clearly.
Yeah, and you do.
Yes.
Despite the fact you'll never awaken. That what you describe, that the reemergence of ignorance after you've abandoned a little bit of it, you've had some relief, and here it comes again.
Mm.
That's only your conditioned mind grasping after maintaining that state.
Yeah.
And you describe what you do beautifully. Come back to the breath.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you do anything else, even I wish I thought about this when Frank brought that up. If you do anything else, such as try to find the origin of it, which is the same as saying analyzing your feelings and your thoughts, you're just putting power into ignorance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can't, there's no.
You're just stirring the pot, really.
You're just stirring the pot, and you're making it more and more murky.
Yeah.
We understand, we start from the point, from the standpoint, from the understanding, as Dhamma practitioners, that ignorance is the problem. So there's no need for me to go, well, where'd the ignorance come from? It's right here in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Hello, Kevin.
Hi, John. How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
Really nice to be here with everybody. I promised that I wasn't going to say anything, and I'm glad I've held off until this long because of what you were saying, and I felt that this would be relevant to it, maybe to help clarify some things. But what I've been understanding or seeing based on the four frames of reference, as we call them now, and they've described them as sort of fog lights that illuminate a fog and help us make frame of, and what I think they're starting to bring into view is the Four Noble Truths very well, and we've talked about them being tasks, and in that further understanding of them being tasks, there's an overarching, maybe why I reached for that word that I want to rescind now, overarching duality to this, and the duality is in complement to a practice such as Qigong, when we do an exercise such as filling and emptying. If we think about that, we're in the world, and that's the cycle of the way the world works. There's it's what are we filling up with? We're filling up with attachments and growing large or getting burned or sticking arrows in, or are we releasing? Are we emptying? Are we letting go? And therein is what you were saying. All these other schools of Buddhism are either or whatever they are, views, ignorance arising.
Yeah.
It's whether we're filling up or releasing. And it almost makes me think of, you know, I was thinking initially of black and white down the middle. But as I'm thinking about this and working and you know, understanding the Dhamma, the clarity really is that it's in a shape of a Tao, right? And the little off, you know, the black speck in the white half is dukkha arising. It will always be there. And if we stir it, we don't have that clarity. We don't have that understanding. We don't have that calm mind. And yeah, that's in motion too. But I feel that the tasks help us clarify that. And that's clears it into stress and suffering or awakening. And it's understand and abandon are the two over here, and experience and practice, experience cessation and practice the Eightfold Path. And then if we're unclear with that, that's just arising and passing away. And that's why we keep doing it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, that was, thank you. It's a really good analogy too. Filling up in the,
yeah. That's
the, that's right.
I really appreciated that from our teachings from,
yeah, that's why I, you know, just
what are we
Qigong is
with?
Such a
what
great compliment to this
in the world,
to this practice. It really is the only, and I should qualify it because of the way Matt teaches it too.
True, from a practitioner's. Yeah.
It's really remarkable. You know, it's one of those things. It's right there, and it's so simple. It's right in your face. Mm-hmm. The Eightfold Path starts with right view. That's the it implies that that's what we're doing. We're developing a view, the acceptance, the beginning of that is that, we'll talk a little bit about this next week, is that if I'm here to develop right view, it must imply that I have
wrong
view.
It's right,
so
where it's wrong.
So let me start here, because here's an awakened human being, a guy that figured it out, that's still willing, after 2,600 years, to still teach me the Dhamma. And he's saying, I'm going to start right here. The First Noble Truth, dukkha occurs. It occurs because of wrong view. And here's a way to develop right view, meaning see myself in relation to the world around me, moment by moment, from that right view. Another word I use is refined mindfulness. Thank you. Hello, Ron.
Hello, John. I'm going to pass for today.
Glad you're here. Tim, how are you tonight?
Yeah, thank you. I wish Frank was still here, because I wanted to. If you notice, Frank was going over things that we've been discussing in the past couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And Michael hit on it. And that is with the mindfulness and the dispassion linked with it. Through dispassion, one won't react. The reaction causes that dukkha.
Or that's right.
It sustains it.
Yeah.
Sustains the dukkha. And it's, I think as humans, we want to connect the dot. Cause effect. And I think we're kind of trained that way.
That's conditioned thinking, yeah.
Right. But it's very complex, and it could be one of many, many things that can stir an emotion within you. But within that moment of reaction, understanding through jhana meditation and developing that skill, we can dispassionately understand that. And I just want to read this again. I read it last week. By dispassionately being mindful of these feelings, thoughts, mindfulness, one can recognize the permanent nature of the external phenomena and internal phenomena and not create a moment of dukkha in the present.
That's brilliant.
Very nice.
And that, wrapped around the Four Noble Truths and all the other aspects of it, anytime that lump gets in your throat, recognize that you're not being dispassionate, that you are getting an emotional reaction, and to get back to the breath. And you said something I thought was incredible, especially as a business owner, and Frank is too, when the workload's overwhelming and the customers are just crazy and all these things are coming at you all different times and you start thinking all these things, that you be mindful that these things happen and go back to the breath and mindfully address them.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of what I'm focusing on. I keep coming back to that dispassion.
Yeah.
It's helping me very much.
Yeah. Well, that again, thank you, Tim. That you could as accurately say dispassion, being dispassionate is awakening as any other description you would, because that's it. You know, this an awakened human being is resting in calm, and they're calm because there's nothing giving rise to passion.
And someone once said, when I had a conversation, they said, well, that's being indifferent. I'm like, no.
There's a big difference.
Big difference between dispassion and indifference.
Yep. Dispassion, indifference is an aspect of ignorance that has developed that strategy to ignore its own ignorance.
That's right.
Simply being present with life as life occurs is the most meaningful experience any human being can ever have.
You still feel sad, you still feel happy, you still could be angry. You just dispassionately attend it.
Yes. You gain the ability to think and feel whatever is appropriate in this moment without the need for it to be any different or to apply blame to yourself or anyone else. Yeah. It's simply when the Buddha heard that his dad was dying, he didn't say, just impermanence. He got up off his cushion and walked as quickly as he could because he wanted to be there before his dad died. And he walked 140 miles, and that's what he did. Some people would say, well, why did he do it? He did it because it was his father, and he cared about him. He didn't lose his mind over it, though. He didn't have to blame someone. He didn't have conjure up old feelings about the time his dad wouldn't give him a brownie. It was just, my dad's dying, time to go see him.
And to be dispassionate is not easy.
It's not easy, but I can tell you, when I talked about this twice already. When I walked into, my father died August 14th, and I hadn't seen, I went to see him in often, but I hadn't seen him for about 2 weeks up until that point. And when I walked into the funeral room, when there he is in the box, and you think that's got to be the worst thing, to see your dad dead in the box. And all I had was this great appreciation for this wonderful man, for being my dad, being my friend all those years, and to last all those years. There wasn't any kind of, and nothing. It was just this most profound feeling of appreciation for that moment, for seeing him in the box. And some people say that's crazy, but I was never more present with him in his life than I was in that. I didn't even realize that until right now, until then. It was remarkable. It still is. I'm not glad that he died, but I'm still I still appreciate what that was. It's such a profound experience. Thank you, Tim. Hello, Mary.
Hello, John. Hello, everybody. It reminds me of hearing the fire discourse for the first time and the profound effect it had on me.
That was on retreat, wasn't it?
The spring of 2016.
Yeah.
And so I just want to say thank you, and I'm enjoying going through the course again. So thank you.
Thank you. Hello, David.
Thank you. I'll be tonight. Thank you.
Thank you. Glad you're here. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, John. Hi, everyone. I'm going to take noble silence.
Glad you're here. Hello, Nick.
Hi. Listening today, I think that maybe this is a... You all can help me. We're going through a difficult time, and one of the difficult things that we're going through is dealing with my mother-in-law, who has... Night is 95 and has Alzheimer's. And no matter how hard we try, we can't help her. We want to help her. We want to get her into an assisted living facility, and she won't go. Okay. She forgets all sorts of things, but she remembers two things: that she's fiercely independent and wants to have her freedom, and how much she hates my wife and I because we're trying to put her in assisted living.
Yep.
Sounds like my mother. We're not doing that to her, but she's afraid we will.
Only two things.
Yeah. And
so we're talking about the Spanish, we're talking about all sorts of things, but I reached a point where I just don't know what to do, and part of me says, and I said to my wife, maybe the best thing for us to do is to walk away. Mm-hmm. And because we can't do anything.
So the this is still a situation that is described in the first noble truth as dukkha occurs. There's nothing personal to you or your wife or even your mother-in-law,
right,
except that you make it so. And of course, how do you not make this personal? Well, understand that this is what happens as a consequence of human life. And as far as what's best for you, I don't know. I can't advise you, except I will tell you that the more well concentrated your mind is and the more framed by the Eightfold Path your thought process is, the clearer the resolution will be. Or it may be another way of saying that when you finally do put her in a assisted living facility, you'll understand it was, like you just said, the only thing you can do. You know, does anybody else have anything else to say about that?
I agree with that. I think that like when the mind is not clear, it doesn't know what's best for itself. So if you guys make a decision to put your mother-in-law in this, or if you put her in, I believe that's right action. You know, I think that's the way I would handle it.
Well, yeah, it's right action based on your own choices. My mom died of Alzheimer's too. It sounds like Johnny's parents' night here. And she was very, very sick for 10 years. It was just brutal. I mean, I can't imagine anything worse than that that's so prolonged. But they kept her at home, and it was really against, there were six of us. Me and my two sisters thought this way, my brothers thought another way. So they kept her at home. And the reason why wasn't so much that I thought it was going to be worse for her, I think it was, but just my father was there day after day, always hoping every time he looked. And she was, it got to a point like she was just like this twisted up little knot. You could hardly tell it was a human being there anymore. And he kept thinking right to the end that she's going to wake up. They were Roman Catholics. And she thought one day, he used to say this, pretty soon we're going to go back to, he used to love going to Cape May for dinner, to the Lobster House. We're going to be going back to there someday. And that's how, and there was no way to get past that. And that's a good reason why it would have been better for everyone if she was put in assisted living. But even through that, there was some, I appreciated the fact when I would go see, I knew there was no, the doctors had said her brainstem was gone, there's nothing there anymore. Yet they kept her alive artificially for other reasons. And so all you can do is be there. It felt awful. And I get, I'm saying this because, Nick, I know you must feel terrible about this. And that is what you're supposed to feel. The confusion, et cetera, is something else, again, that the Dhamma can help you with. But it's an awful situation. And as a compassionate human being, you should feel awful.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yes, yes, I understand that. But you haven't been here for a while because things are just in a turmoil right now. Trying to get back to meditating properly, I really am having difficulty. Just meditating, I'm having difficulty.
Well, do you try to get here as often as you can? But I mean, you know, this is kind of a foundation. It continues to inform your practice. And if you're having trouble meditating, cut back for a few minutes. You know, maybe cut back to, I don't know what you've been meditating. If you've been meditating for 20, try cutting back to 5 or 10, and do that twice a day. And in stressful times, that's just a good idea. Don't abandon your practice. You're better off doing that than just abandoning it completely. You know, and then try to be a part. And always feel free to give me an email or give me a call too. But thank you for bringing that tonight to all of us.
One thing that I'd suggest is, start noticing how often you move away from the feelings that are arising. And in what you're doing to get away, to jettison away from what's occurring. When you feel sad, when you feel helpless, that's what's occurring.
It's not just me. It's
of course,
myself and my wife.
It's your wife, it's you.
She's...
Of course.
I've never seen her like this before.
Of course, it's, you know, it's tremendous what occurs in life, you know, And, you know, if you can try not to look at it as something that you can solve and start noticing, start paying attention to how you're moving away from what's occurring.
Yeah, and also understand that the most effective thing you can do to support your wife is your own mindful presence.
Yes.
You know, because the rest of it, like Matt said, you can't fix it.
Nope.
You know?
Cannot fix it.
So there's a saying that's not Buddhist. It's acceptance is the answer to all our problems. And in this case, it may go a long way to simply accept this is what's occurring. And maybe you don't put her in a home. I mean, I'm not saying that you should do that either. But if you can get to the point where you simply accept what's occurring within the stressful situation, that's Dhamma practice. This 95-year-old woman with Alzheimer's, I don't care who you are, it's stressful. But you don't have to contribute to your stress by reacting to it. And that's it. You might read, if you get a chance, and if you forget this, just send me an email. Read the Salata Sutta, because it directly addresses that. How we, through our reacting to what's occurring, whatever is occurring to be different, we simply create more stress, and it's apropos to what you're going through. So thanks for bringing that up, Nick.
Thank you.
Michael, good to see you tonight.
Same here, John. Nick, can I just talk
please
about this for just one moment? Maybe this will help you make things a little clearer. I have a lifelong friend of mine, my friend Anne. I knew her since I was 5 years old. We grew up in Brooklyn together. And Anne had... She had four siblings, okay? Oh, no, I'm sorry. Yeah, four siblings. She has an older brother, okay? And she has a younger sister. The sister's the youngest. And then she had two boys in between. They were older than the youngest girl. Anyhow, the two boys were mentally challenged, okay? And very difficult, not so much that they actually had a very, you know, compromised life. So they had to eventually, Anne also was married to one of my best friends who died at 52 years old to lung cancer. She lost her mother when she was 16. She lost her father. So she's had a lot of losses in her life. But one thing she's always done, she's always watched over her handicapped brothers. One of the brothers, the older one, Jimmy, died 4 or 5 years ago, maybe a little bit longer. So I know that's difficult because, you know, especially he had a compromised life and he was a good soul, you know, but it's sad when you see someone who really wasn't well, and it's just a very sad thing. Anyhow, so that left is the one more brother, Kevin, who is a little bit younger than Jimmy. And I think at this time he's like, maybe he's 50 years old, okay? So Kevin was living in an apartment in my friend Ann's house, okay? And she's taking care of him for the whole time, never put him into a home, never did anything, you know, but take care of him lovingly, treated him like gold. To a point where Kevin started suffering from dementia, okay? He started breaking things in the apartment, acting out. And there was she has no choice. What do you do? She's 60 years old. What is she to do anymore? She can't control, you know, the actions of this handicapped handicapped man, you know? And her heart is broken from this, because having to put her brother in a place far away from Staten Island, in the Bronx, as a matter of fact, so it's not that easy to get to. But anyhow, she made the decision, because it was the only decision she had to, because she couldn't take care of him anymore,
yeah.
And decided that she had to do this.
Yeah.
Okay? You know, I listened to her whole story, and I know Kevin very well. He's a sweetheart of a kid. But again, he's diminished. His mental faculties are diminishing. So when I listened to Anne, I thought to myself, my God, how difficult of a decision was that for her to make?
Yeah.
You know? And what I realized then, that you know what? Right action, a lot of times, is making hard decisions also. You know? It's easy to make the easy decisions on things, but the hard decisions, like Nick, you're facing a really hard decision here. That's the difficult thing. But sometimes, and I'm not telling you what to do, but I'm just saying, like, sometimes we have to make the hard decisions because that is right action. And although we might not feel that it's what's best for us, what do we want to do, but it's the right action in relation to the caretaking of someone who can't take care of themselves anymore and we can't take care of them anymore.
And that whole situation you describe is the first noble truth. And as we develop the Dhamma, we gain the ability, we develop right action. And so we will naturally come to that. I mean, I'm saying this to you, Nick, and all of us, we're very fortunate that we have this Dhamma practice so we can engage in right action when it's appropriate. Thank you, Michael.
Can I just finish? I'm
sorry.
thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I hope things work out. You know, like what we're talking about tonight seemed like what had taken over this discussion tonight was how do we get past these difficult times, or how do we live the Dhamma in everyday life with all the interactions we have, you know, on a daily basis. And John, let me ask you a question. Is there any time when the mind should not be united with the body?
I can't imagine.
There's not. And what is that that unites the mind with the body is the breath. Yes?
It's the breath initially, and then it's a profound right view that keeps it there.
Exactly. Okay. So, uniting the mind with the body, okay? So many stressful things come up during the day. Everyone has them as they go through their lives. It's the way I understand it, or the way I try, you know, Julie and I talk about this all the time. Obviously, everyone has stress in their life, but we're constantly trying to understand how to apply the Dhamma, okay? And I think we have to be mindful of the breath as often as we can, and not just go to a breath, you know, just take one breath or two breaths, several breaths, or for a longer period of time. Because what it does, I've noticed this myself, what it does, it enables me to be dispassionate about what is occurring. It also keeps me in the moment, keeps me present. And it doesn't keep, and again, because we are hit with a barrage of distractions throughout a day. So if we don't somehow fend off those distractions, we are not going to have a peaceful mind, or we're not going to have a calm mind. And being equanimous is not something that's an option. But if the mind is united with the body, and we make a concerted effort to unite the mind with the body and develop that dispassion, that also, if that's basically what we do in jhana meditation, this enables us, as we go through our days, no matter what may come our way, is we become non-reactive. When our mind is united with the body. Being non-reactive doesn't mean not to have compassion or not to have feelings, but that ability to be non-reactive, and again, this passion will bring that, breaks down. That doesn't allow those conditioned responses to come forward, to those reactionary conditioned responses to leap forward. They're held back until we can like think, you know, what's the best way of handling something? And obviously, you know, and you right view right out the gate. So that's the way I view this thing. And I just want to know what your thoughts are in relation to that.
Well, I thank you. I agree with you, everything you said. The mindful response to life is simply just that. When it's framed by the Eightfold Path, our minds remain at peace, and the people and events around us tend to remain at peace too. It's just like that. Thank you, Michael. Hello, Julia.
Hello, John. Noble silence for tonight.
I'm glad you're here. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And Jane is the only one left. Ryan had to leave. So thank you all for a good class. It's gotten a little bit late, but we'll finish with metta. So your homework is to read chapter 4, the wisdom aspects of the Eightfold Path. Write a little bit about it because you'll learn something that way. And we'll discuss that next Tuesday. These are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you, John.
See you, Jane.
Thank you, John. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.